Welcome to Worlds Apart. The conflict in Ukraine has manifested a new security paradox in Europe. Many in the West contend that until Russia is fully democratic, whatever that means, Ukraine will need Western security guarantees and its active military support. For its part, Moscow believes that until global governance is truly multipolar, whatever that means, any extension of foreign military infrastructure towards Russian borders will be considered an existential security threat. Can these two contentions be reconciled without another continental war in Europe? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Thomas Gramminger, director of the Geneva Center for Security Policy and former secretary general of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. It's great to see you, great to talk to you, and I have to express a double gratitude for being here in Moscow because, to be honest with you, we don't see many Western visitors here these days. Did you have any second thoughts about coming here because of, you know, reputational risks to yourself personally and the organization that you're heading?
There were advisors that indeed, you know, warned me about traveling to Moscow at this time. But, you know, I always believed in dialogue, and dialogue, I think, is particularly important in times of crisis. And so not coming to Moscow was basically for me not an issue after I got the invitation to these prestigious Primakov readings. And I don't regret to have come. I think I've had excellent discussions within the setting of the conference, but also, of course, taking advantage to talk to quite a number of important representatives, both within and without. Outside of the state structures.
Now, you've been talking about the fact that this conflict may have not only regional but also global implications, and I think we are increasingly seeing that, at least when, as far as sanctions are concerned. But I wonder, as a former head of the OSCE, what do you make of the fact that this potentially very dangerous situation is being dealt with by the policy of boycott and ostracizing Russia, which I think is preferred course of action for many European countries as well as for the United States?
Well, look, on the one hand, I have understanding for a very determined attitude by Western countries regarding this very severe breach of international law that the Russian military invasion in Ukraine represents. But at the same time, I think it is particularly in these times, it's important to remain on speaking terms, to discuss, and if it's at least to prevent further escalation, but also if we want to come out of the current situation, we need platforms for dialogue. So, you know, while I'm in favor of, you know, very clear term language, at the same time, I don't believe that isolating, excluding an important interlocutor serves the purpose of managing conflict and of taking us closer to resolving a conflict.
You mentioned the need for platforms for dialogue, and the OSCE, the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, which you used to head a few years back, was once considered such a platform. And I interviewed you a couple of years back when you just assumed that leadership position. And at that time, there were already doubts whether the OSCE was relevant. Do you think it's still relevant given that not only it failed to prevent an active kinetic conflict between Russia and Ukraine, and some would argue Russia and the West, but it also now being used as a platform for political posturing and pushing out one of the sides. I'm speaking about Russia. Do you think the OIC currently stands for either security or cooperation?
I would absolutely admit that currently the OIC is in crisis. Clearly, I think there is no doubt about it, which is not to say, you know, that the OIC wouldn't still do very valid work, be it through its field missions in the Western Balkans, in Central Asia, or in parts of Eastern Europe, be it through its institutions, through its, the programmatic work of its secretariat. But of course, this is politically not particularly relevant. I think what participating states of the OIC would have hoped is the OIC being able to play a role in either preventing or at least now in managing the conflict between Russia and Ukraine, or Russia and the West.
By the way, how do you see it, given that you are now in a less diplomatic position, you perhaps more freedom have, you perhaps can afford yourself more freedom of speech. Do you see that as a conflict between Russia and Ukraine or something larger?
I think it's an overlapping conflict. And this is, by the way, not new. This was, I think, something that we saw for years, these two lines of conflict, the more narrow between Russia and Ukraine, and the wider between Russia and the West. But I would immediately add that both conflicts could have been managed in a non-violent way. And I regret, you know, that we missed many opportunities to do so, and including at the OIC, you know, and at the OIC we had platforms to deal with both lines of conflict. But important stakeholders, important participating states of the OIC chose not to use these tools, only partly.
Whom do you mean by those important stakeholders?
Well, look, let's take the example of arms control. We've been witnessing for years this polarization, less and less trust among key stakeholders of European security, and an unraveling of a very complex web of arms control agreements that, you know, have been built up since the end of the Cold War and served quite well, provided us with peace and stability. So we witnessed that unraveling of this architecture.
Grimminger, if I may interrupt you here just for a second, because you're trying to be very neutral and diplomatic, and I understand why, but are we doing the peace and the deconflicting efforts service when we are trying to sort of smooth the lines so diplomatically here? Because it's not just the random unraveling, isn't it? It's the West taking a decision, making a decision that they want to pursue certain policies that went strongly against Russian interests. And those Russian interests and concerns were very clearly communicated for many, many number of years. Are we doing reality? Are we doing truth disservice when we just describe it as simple unraveling?
It's, I would agree with you that it was with some of these pillars of this arms control architecture, it was indeed the United States that pulled out of it. But what I was trying to say is that at the OIC, we tried to provide, alternative platforms. For instance,
did they listen to you? Did
there
they
was, for instance, a structured dialogue created by a decision of a ministerial council held in Hamburg end of 2016. And I think for a while there was, hope that this platform would serve to discuss military risk reduction, confidence and security building measures, and perhaps also create, again, a common understanding on how to resume serious arms control conditions, negotiations. But unfortunately, this offer was not taken up. And it's true. The West, NATO, did not seem to be particularly interested. But frankly, also from the Russian Federation, I did not really sense this urgency, you know, to kind of get back and try to reinvigorate this arms control architecture. So there was, I think, a lack of interest by all relevant stakeholders, and this was frustrating. And look, and the same is true for the other example that I wanted to address, and that is the Minsk agreements, you know, that tried to deal with the conflict in the Donbas. And I think, of course, being far from perfect, but they would have represented the blueprint to resolve at least the conflict in the Donbas partly. But with the exception of a relatively short period of time, I think there was never, at the same time, a genuine political commitment on either side to take these agreements seriously. On the one side, there was a reluctance to implement, to tackle the political provisions. On the other, there was a reluctance to really deal seriously with the security provisions. And basically, there was an ongoing blame game and a fight, what should come first. Well, political provisions or security provisions?
Well, that fight was going on as Donbas was being continuously shelled from the Ukrainian side, and the majority of the death toll, we know that, like it's documented, and in part thanks to the OSCE missions, that the majority of casualties of that war starting from 2014 was on the eastern Ukrainian side, on the separatist side. But putting that aside, I want to ask you about sort of the whether the negotiating process holds any prospect whatsoever at this point, because Russia took a very dramatic step for itself. I think many Russians are shocked by the actions of the Russian government. It only came at the time, I think, when the decision makers would come to a point or to a conclusion when they would not believe in the negotiating process. And I think there is a strong sense in Moscow that peace process, deconflicting efforts have been methodically abused, that all the negotiations are used simply as a measure of getting some respite for military action and never are never committed to with, you know, a will to implement that. Is there any legitimacy to that kind of opinion?
I would agree that, you know, the sides, and I use the plural intentionally and not diplomatically, the sides were there were certain time periods, but they were never overlapping, when I felt there was a genuine commitment to move forward with implementing the Minsk agreements. For instance, a few months after President Zelensky took power, I really had the feeling that there was a genuine commitment. But then, you know, the window of opportunity closed. And when I left my mandate as Secretary General, I kind of, you know, felt that we are in the midst of something very protracted, and I didn't see a way out, which, in my view, doesn't justify a war, but I have sympathy with the frustration. But again, I would put the blame on both sides for this lack of genuine will to implement the Minsk agreements.
Okay, well, Mr. Germinger, we have to take a very short break right now, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned. Fracture Worlds Apart with Thomas Gramminger, Director of the Geneva Center for Security Policy and former Secretary General of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. Mr. Gramminger, in 2025, the Helsinki Act, the founding document for the OSCE, will mark its 50th anniversary, and it has some beautiful principles there that actually helped us put an end to the Cold War. And I think when that act was signed, there was a clear recognition that differences exist and that they have to be dealt with. And yet, when we look at Europe right now, there seems to be so much stress on unity that there's barely any room for even negotiation, not only between Russia and Europe or Russia and the West, but even within the West. Why do you think 50 years after the creation of the OSCE, which is supposedly dedicated to freedom of speech, to, you know, dialogue, as contentious as it may be, why do you think there's such a fervor, such a demand on uniform agreement within the Western camp?
I think we have come back to an era of very tough geopolitical competition. And unfortunately, you know, the principles that you refer to that were agreed in the framework of the Helsinki Final Accord in 1975 and recommitted by states again in 1999, 2010 in Astana. Unfortunately, while nobody questions these principles, I think there has, at least lately, not been a serious attempt to deal with dilemmas between these principles. And these dilemmas, they imply, these principles imply dilemmas that need to be addressed. And if they are not addressed, they lead to growing tensions and conflict. And let me illustrate that point. You know, there is, regarding all those states that are geographically between the Russian Federation and NATO. There is, and you alluded to it in your introductory comments, there is an issue with their status, right? Because you have the indivisibility of security.
Let's be specific with their security status, because Russia never precluded them from developing their democracy, their markets, whatever they want. The issue was always, as the name of that organization stresses, on security.
Correct. So there are two principles that bite each other if they're not addressed diplomatically. There is the principle of indivisibility of security. That is, you as a state shouldn't increase your security at the expense of another. And there is another principle that allows you as a state to freely choose your security arrangements. Now, if you apply these two principles to states like Georgia, Ukraine, Armenia, Azerbaijan, Belarus, or Moldova, you have a dilemma. And you can try to solve this dilemma by force, but that's probably not advisable. I think there are diplomatic means to deal with this issue, and that would probably then lead to an agreement on the status of these countries that is close to non-alignment, neutrality, something like that, combined with security guarantees, combined perhaps with arms control agreements, you know, that would prevent, for instance, NATO in establishing NATO infrastructure at the Ukrainian-Russian border.
Do you think that's still a reality, specifically on the principle of indivisibility of security? Because I heard you say, at some panel, that you would love the countries, the member states, by 2025, not only recommit to the old principles, but to try to redefine them in a new way that would be workable for all. Do you think that's still a possibility?
I think not by 2025. But, you know, if you think conflict prevention long-term in the Euro-Atlantic and Eurasian area, I don't see any other way than to deal with the dilemmas between these principles. I don't think
a global conflict could be one way of dealing with it, don't you think?
Absolutely,
so?
And I think you wouldn't that, I wouldn't it either. And I think at some point we need to come back to the negotiation table, and then building on that, trying to reconstruct the European security order, that allows us to recommit to these principles, but by openly addressing these dilemmas. And I think that is a vision. It's not going to happen tomorrow, but it might happen if there is political will in 5-8 years.
Well, for that to happen, the sides also need to come to a certain calculus that peace is more beneficial for their goals than war. And I think on the Russian side, it's easier to define where the Russians can draw their line, because we've been very open about it. But what about the West? When do you think the Western powers will calculate that peace is better for their long-term security goals than war, or than a proxy conflict? Yeah.
Look, I don't have a crystal ball, but I would agree with you that what Bill Sartman calls the mutually hurting stalemate, which makes a conflict ripe for resolution, is not reached yet. And I think both sides still seem to believe that by military means they can reach a much more advantageous negotiation position. I wouldn't exclude that at some point, attrition, exhaustion sets in, And there is a resumption of negotiations, but for the time being, the most realistic scenario that I see for months to come is unfortunately continuation of a high intensity conflict. Mm-hmm.
Now, in previous conflicts in which European powers took part, in previous conflicts of this century, the cost to the European population was either minimal or none. This time around, it's different than the economic and energy cooperation that has long served as the pillar of both stability and conflict prevention in Europe has been severed. How big of a challenge is it for European countries as far as you're concerned? And do you think that will lead to any sort of reassessment in values or political commitments in Europe?
I would absolutely agree that the costs have been enormous in humanitarian terms, in economic terms, in political terms. If you see us currently again moving in some sort of a Cold War, but I think in the short term, energy shortages, etc. I think they're being dealt with. People suffer, but my perception, the political situation in European countries is clearly, that this solidarity with Ukraine is such that these sufferings are taken into account, so it's neither the refugee flows nor the energy shortages that will change, at least in the medium term, the perception of the European audience.
I remember that in the OSCE golden years, there was a lot of tension between political rights and economic rights, and more developed, more prosperous countries were sort of in the habit of preaching down to less prosperous and, in their view, authoritarian neighbors, and sort of prioritizing political rights over the economic necessity. Given that Europe, for the first time this century, has to actually struggle with fulfillment of economic rights for its own citizens, do you think it may change the discourse, at least in general, and the realization how important is economy versus politics?
I hope it will lead us again to recognize how important a comprehensive approach to security is. And basically, the political rationale of the CSE and the OSCE was always combining political military issues, military affairs, hard security, if you want, economic and environmental affairs, the second dimension, and the human dimension, meaning respect for human rights, rule of law, and democratic institutions. And I agree with you, there has been the history of the OEC is a history of playing one dimension against the other. But again, at the same time, the organization has always been proud for its comprehensive approach to security. And as a Secretary General, I have always reminded participating states at the end, you know, security consists of these different dimensions, and we should also be respectful of different dimensions and also respect other states, you know, that may perceive economic and environmental affairs to be more relevant, mm-hmm. like the Central Asians.
Well, they always essentially, you're saying that we have to be respectful of diversity, which don't you think has become a rather controversial proposition these days, that diversity of views, political, economic, humanitarian views should be respected?
I agree with you, but this is unfortunately this is a feature of the extremely polarized political environment that we are currently in. It's a feature of a Cold War for those of us that have lived through Cold War 1.0.
Even in the Cold War, correct me if I'm wrong, because I was born in the final years of the Cold War, but I remember that at that time, difference was actually respected because it was dangerous. There was a realization, there was fear that if you don't respect your partner enough, you know, the world can blow up into pieces. Do you think that fear, that respect for the enemy is there?
I think there is still, at least among the major powers, there is still a certain respect, you know, for instance, for the concept of mutually assured destruction. I think that hasn't been seriously undermined, fortunately. But, you know, what was a typical feature of the Cold War was basically these images of the enemy, ideology. I'm right, you're wrong. By definition. And I think I see that happen again. And on both sides, you know, I wander between the worlds, mm-hmm. and I'm struck by that. And so both sides invest a lot in narratives that are then being sold, marketed as the sole truth.
Mm-hmm. Well, at that time, back in the 70s, the two sides were wise enough to come up with a new forum, a new East-West forum to try to discuss those differences. Let's keep our fingers crossed that is still possible in this day and age. In any case, I really appreciate your bravery and your candor in this interview. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your interest.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart. We'll be right back.